Yes, hoi nun fioi. Hoi nun fioi. Omicroniote endings. Number three, the fruits. Don't worry about accents now. You don't know the rules for changing them anyway. Hoi carpoi. Yes, hoi carpoi. Number four, the vines. Watch this one.
Hi.
Hi umpeloi. Hi umpeloi. Gotta watch it because. Huh?
How do you know?
Well, you only know it from the article form. You see, just above, they gave you the vine, hey umpelos. Since you know it's hey umpelos, you know from umpelos it's second declension. You know from hey it's feminine. Okay? So, from the fact that it's hey umpelos in the nominative singular, it's going to have to be hi for the article for the because it's feminine. And then it's going to be umpeloi because it's second declension. Okay? Number five, the sons. What's that? Poi huioi. Good. The gods. Poi theoi. And that word does occur in the plural in the New Testament. When Jesus said, "No, you're not, you are gods." That's what it is. Poi theoi. The powers.
Hi,
yes, hi exousiai. Hi exousiai. And the men? Poi anthropoi. Yes. Poi anthropoi. It's actually anthropoi. So the accent will shift, but you don't know why yet. Okay. Any questions on any of those forms? Anybody having a fundamental problem in figuring out how to fill these out? It's just a matter if you've got that chart that I put on the board last week with the various declensions and so forth, the endings that you have. It's just a matter of knowing what the article is so you know the gender. That's the only way you're going to know the gender is to know the article. And then by the endings on the word so far, at least, you can tell what declension it is. Just the nominative form will tell you what the declension is when you're only dealing with first and second declension. Later, when we get to second third declensions, you'll find that won't always be the case. Yes?
How did he determine what it was?
That's just from the dictionary. That's just from, see, that's part of what you learn in the lexicon. Yeah. In other words, that's... Right, he just gave you the information here that you would have found in the lexicon. So, in other words, if you want to find, you know, say, ampelos, for example, you look it up in the lexicon, and it'll say ampelos, comma, omicron upsilon, which gives you the genitive form, and then comma, hey, which gives you the article, which tells you the gender. That's the only place you're going to find that information. And then in the vocabulary list, of course, they're just giving you the dictionary forms, and you just memorize them. This is why it's so important when you learn a Greek noun to learn the article that goes with it. And learn it automatically. Consider it a part of the noun. In learning it, because that's the only way you're going to be able to unambiguously determine the gender. You can make some pretty fairly reasonable guesses if you see a form with no article on it and it ends in omicron sigma and it's clearly a nominative, then you can pretty well guess that it's going to be masculine because most of those are masculine. But you might be wrong because it might be something like ampelos that was feminine or hodos. So, you know, your odds are pretty good in guessing it right most of the time, but don't trust that. Ultimately, the only way you'll know for sure is to know the article form. And that comes just purely from the vocabulary. When I give you vocabulary lists on the board probably next week, you'll see that I'll give you the article form with the nouns, and then with adjectives there'll be some other types of things that will information will give you also that'll tell you exactly how to make all the forms, basically. Okay. 7E then, referring to the sentences in paragraph 50 and the two exercises on page W22, translate the following into Greek. Okay, the man has sons. Now this, you're just basically going to have to copy the verb form from another sentence that's got a similar form. In other words, there's no way that you know how to predict that. But on the basis of the examples that's been already given, and then on the basis of knowing how to put the nouns in the various forms, accusative or masculine, singular, plural, accusative or nominative, singular, plural, you're expected to be able to translate these. So, the man has sons. How would you say that in Greek? Yes, ho anthropos eche huius. The eche you just get from one of the other examples. You can get it from sentence 5 on page 40 in your textbook. So he just tells you to look through there, and you just find the one that says has, and you've got it. So eche is the form. So in this case, it's holanthropos singular, eche huius. Or you could have said huius, eche holanthropos, or you could have said eche holanthropos huius, or you could put it in any word order you want there. Yes?
How would you know that that's supposed to have an article in it?
Only because it says the man has sons rather than the man has the sons. If it said the man has the sons, then you'd put the article on. No. No, in English you wouldn't normally say it as the sons. And it's only the word God is about the only word I know of that normally is going to use the article in Greek where it doesn't use it in English. So it's basically, if the article is used in English, at least for right now, we'll get some refinement on this, but at least for right now, if the article is on the thing in English, then put the article in Greek. If the article is not on it in English, then omit the article in Greek. If there's an indefinite article in English, put the anarthrous form or no article form in Greek. In other words, indefinite article means, suppose it said the man has, well, you wouldn't do it with this, but suppose it was singular, the man has a son. Then it would just be ho anthropos eche huion. Number three does? Okay, good. Yeah, there's a good example of it. Just no article there because the indefinite article in English is going to come out as anarthrous in Greek. Now, there will be some refinement to this a little bit later on, but yes.
I saw in the Greek New Testament that some of the sentences start with a capitalized word, and many of them do not. Why? And down here in the next section, it doesn't capitalize the first word of those sentences.
No, I think he's just not being real formal and strict here. I think mainly he's just wanting you to be able to see things without complicating things with capitals. Because really, now this is just a matter of technique more than anything else, a matter of the way the texts are set up. Your standard UBS and Westcott and Hort texts, as we find them now, will use capital letters to start sentences. The thing that the reason that you see some differences in some cases is because the verse numbers aren't lining up. Like I think I can't remember now. I don't have my text with me, but generally you're going to see them capitalize the first letter and follow. I think there might be some complications sometimes when the English King James split up the verses a little differently than they did, and they may have chosen to stick the capital earlier. So in other words, you might see. I think there's one in John 1:4, isn't it? Where it says ho gego, it doesn't capitalize the ho there. Okay. So then there's nothing. They don't capitalize the first word in verse 4. Then do they? They split up or okay. So that's probably an example you're thinking of. They're kind of getting stuck between two things there because they've decided to divide the verses differently than the King James. Yes, John.
Just looking at this, like in verse 15, it says capitalize the one name, and then farther on after a comma. And then right after that, another comma, and then it
capitalizes both. Okay,
let me see. All one verse? Yeah. That's all within the verse. I never really noticed that before. Okay, yeah, and then a lot of the verses, they are capitalizing here. No, I guess it's just going to depend on text to text. I think if you look at what's happening here is in these particular cases there's a quotation that's starting. In other words, take an allego and say, "Utos in on a pon." This is the one who said, and then there's another quotation within that quotation. Oh, this on move. Those are all quotations.
Right.
And
in the cut, it's a boldface type that's used to identify direct quotations from the Old Testament.
Well, that's boldface though. That's boldface where it's quotation from the Old Testament.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I think what's happening is they're still capitalizing a sentence at the first letter of the sentence. It's just that a verse doesn't always, in other words, the Greek kind of flows. The verse number in English, where we might start a new sentence, there's no new sentence in Greek. It just continues on. And it's just like a comma or something, and they continue on. And then there'll be some cases where a quotation will be made, and something like legon or apon or something like that usually precedes it. And instead of using quotation marks, they'll set that off with that word, and then they'll put the next word in capitals. And so I think they're still observing this basic distinction. It's just that it doesn't always line up in English and in Greek the same. So what's a sentence in Greek may be a lot longer than what's a sentence in English. We're breaking it down into different sentences. So basically the text, I think, they're capitalizing the first letter of a sentence, but you have to watch the punctuation. And then there'll be variations from text to text because the punctuation's put in different places. See, what you have to remember is that the original unsealed manuscripts were all run together with all capitals. And so the editors are making some decisions as far as where they're going to make their sentence divisions and so forth, and that's going to result in some variations in how they mark it. So basically what you have to do is look at the beginning and find out how each text is going to handle it. And as far as modern Greek is concerned, I think them is just, you know, they capitalize the first letter of a sentence, pretty much punctuate like we do. But in the textbook, he's not always going to be watching real close on that just because he's trying to focus on the, you know, exercises are kind of disjointed pieces anyway. Yes?
Quotations and direct speech are introduced by capital letters and by commas.
Okay.
Right.
Quotations, direct speech. Okay. That's what we saw there in that example. So, yeah, good point. Okay, but you have to watch and be careful because one text may not do exactly the same as the other. And their punctuation, you'll see, will vary. And even in UBS, they've got footnotes down at the bottom indicating various texts that punctuated it differently. In other words, they may have punctuated a certain way with commas in a certain place. Westcott and Hort might have done it differently. Trigelles and Titian Dorf and others might have done it differently. And they'll often tell you which editors did it which way. Okay. And that's always important to recognize that there are more than one possibility as far as punctuation on a Greek sentence. We don't tamper with the text, but remember that the punctuation is not part of the original text. And so it's worthy to consider options on that. Okay, seldom is either going to make any huge difference, mainly one of emphasis. Number two, then, under 7e, God calls the steward. How would we say that in Greek? God calls the steward. Phoné? Yes, tone architriclinon. Yes, os phoné. Phoné, tone architriclinon. Or you could have rearranged the word order there in lots of different ways. Tone architriclinon, phoné, hotheos, or phoné, hotheos, tone architriclinon, or whatever. I don't care what order you put it in, provided that the articles always come right before their nouns. You can shift the order around if you want. Okay, but main thing, though, is make sure hotheos is nominative and tone architriclinon is accusative. Then number three, the bridegroom planted a tree. How would we say that? Glenn? Yes. O numphios ephutu sen dendron. No article on dendron. Okay? So o numphios ephutu sen, I guess that form was given to you someplace in one of the sentences. Yeah, okay. So to dendron. Just dendron. Dendron. Okay? Any questions? We'll figure out how to figure out these verb forms later on, but for right now, you can just accept them for what they're. What was that? Yes. That's right. And they will inflect for numbers, so I think he's given you almost all these subjects are singulars anyway, so you don't have to worry about it. In other words, if he had mixed singular and plural subjects and so forth, then you'd have singular and plural verb forms in there, and you'd probably be confused trying to figure out which is which. But fortunately, he's made it simple enough for you to be able to do it. Okay? Because, see, these verb forms are gonna vary. Suppose it was, hoi numphioi instead of ho numphios, then my verb form would have to change. I'd have to have the plural third person form, and that'd be ephutusi or something like this, or ephutusin instead of ephutusen. So, okay, or excuse me, it'd be ephutususin. Okay, but we'll worry about that later. That's coming in due time. He holds that off a little bit. We try to get these nouns all figured out first. And up in chapter 12, we start with the basic verb form. Well, it's not too far away. We're in chapter 8 today, so we'll take the verb piece by piece, because there's a lot of pieces. Okay. Exercise 7F, then. Fill in the blank in each Greek sentence with Greek words of the appropriate case so that it will be a translation of the English sentence which precedes it. Okay. The earth brought forth the trees, hege, eblastisen, what? Ta dendra. Right, ta dendra. I want the accusative, neuter, plural form. Number two, the earth brought forth vines. Ampelus eblastisen blank. Ege. Now it's the subject that we want in the blank, because the object's already given. The vine brought forth the fruit, ton carpon, eblastisen, what? He ampelos. Yeah, the subject again, he ampelos, the vine. Number four, a man planted the trees, ephutusen anthropos, blank. Toadendron, yeah, the tree, the toadendron, right. God loved the earth, agapesen ho theos, what? Tain gain, yes. Tau edenu, gamma edenu. The man has power, ho anthropos eke exousion, yes, exousion. Number seven, the world has power, exousion eke ho cosmos, right, subject there. So just changing the word order around on you here. Here it gives you one of the verb form, just for fun. God has a son. Huyon ho theos eke. Yes, eke. Epsilon chi epsilon iota. Okay, then number nine, the bridegroom calls the men. Phone ho num theos blank. Tous anthropus. It's actually, the accent changes, but don't worry about that. You don't have to worry about it. Tous anthropus. Okay, omicron upsilon sigma. Okay, number 10, the man loved God. Agapesen ho anthropos ton theon. Yes, ton theon. The word God will almost always have the article. In other words, just assume it has a article. There are some times when it doesn't.
I find it in English with the article, but how do you know it's got the article?
Well, the thing is that in Greek, it most often has the article. In Greek, when it's referring to God as a personal identity, it will use the article. And that's one of the kind of an unusual uses of the article. In other words, that doesn't hold for all nouns, but for the word God, when God is being used, it's obviously referring to the person of God, there'll be the article in Greek, whereas in English we won't use the article. We don't say the God, we will just say God. There are places in the Greek where God does not have the article, and it's referring to the true God, but it's not referring to so much his identity as to qualities and characteristics of him. It's kind of an interesting thing that you see it in John 1:1, for example. NRK ein ho logos, kai ho logos ein pros ton theon. Now, pros ton theon, you've got the article there, ton theon. And then it says, kai theos ein ho logos. Now you've got theos with no article on that last phrase. So, right, one phrase has got the article, and the next phrase doesn't have the article. And in English, we just translated God in both places. But there, in Greek, there's a definite difference between them. And that difference is picked up when you're reading it in Greek. It's hard to sometimes express in English, but it's picked up when you're reading Greek. So after we get exposed to this quite a bit more, you'll begin finding yourself sensing the difference between ho theos and theos. But to tell somebody who's speaking English what the difference is a little bit hard. Basically, ho theos is emphasizing the identity of God as a person. Theos without the article is emphasizing more the qualities and characteristics of God. Sometimes translate, I think some translations render that John 1:1, and the word was divine rather than the word was God. It's not drawing an equation between the word and the person of God. It's just showing that the word is God, but God is more than the word. It's really difficult to nail it down in so many words in English, but it's very, very definitely something you're picking up from the Greek. Yes. Tony, do you have? They come in and say, A God there. Yeah. That's the one, yeah. See, the Jehovah's Witnesses are polytheists. They believe in a lower God, you see, and so they translated A God. But they even quote Dane and Manthe in one of their things to justify that. Dane and Manthe wrote him a scathing letter back and said, we don't want you quoting from us at all anymore. You know? Okay. It's really, I think we've got a copy of it in the library someplace.
We've got a tape in the tape library.
Do we?
Dane and Manthe
talking
about the
collection. Is that right? No, I've seen the letter that they wrote.
I've heard that in Dane and Manthe's manual, a brief manual.
Uh-huh. He actually has a small part at the very back where he can fly.
They might have in some of the newer editions of that too, yeah. Because I mean that hit a sore point with them. They didn't want the Jehovah's Witnesses quoting them, associating their name with their doctrine. I don't blame them at all. Okay, did we finish this?
Yeah.
Okay. Now the number 10 should be. Yeah, I guess we did finish it. Okay. Okay. You should have the article here. Yeah, you should have the article here. If you didn't put it down, go ahead and put it down. Just kind of get in the habit of it. Since it's the man loved God, we know it's talking about the person of God, then you will have the article. Yes. So.
There are, it seems to me, there seems to be many nouns that don't translate well. Have
articles
on it. Mm-hmm. They don't translate
them
with articles because we would
get right. Yes. Theos is the most common of those, but there are other examples of the same thing. It's just very stilted in English to be saying the all the time. We don't use the article quite as frequently as the Greek does. And we'll be doing, especially in the second year, we're going to do a whole section on the article and the uses of the article and try to really refine that as much as possible. But it's a very, very interesting thing. The Greek is probably the most interesting language I know of that with regard to the use of the article. Very interesting. And it's something that needs to be understood to properly evaluate grammatical situations. That and the prepositions, I think, those are two areas we'll spend quite a bit of time in the second year. Okay, then going back to our lesson 8 that we began yesterday, we want to look at this other important sentence type here. Well, actually, it deals with two sentence types here. He deals first with a subject verb and then an optional adverb, just a simple subject verb type of sentence that may have an adverb that further qualifies it. And Greek is basically the same as English in that respect, and we left off at section 54 looking at that. Yes, Glenn?
I wanted to ask about that subject verb adverb.
Mm-hmm.
That adverb, I mean, he gives it as a, you know, in the structural context of English, where the adverb replaces the very object in that place, but in English, adverb can float all over the place.
Right, yes. Yeah, the English word order isn't going to be so restricted as far as where the adverb goes. In other words, it could be the judge coughed apologetically, or you could say apologetically, the judge coughed. Or the judge apologetically coughed. You know, that adverb can fit in a lot of different positions there. The subject and verb relationship is still going to be pretty much fixed as far as order. You wouldn't be likely to hear coughed the judge, unless there might be some cases in which he had a bunch of other stuff. You know, if he was saying something, you know, and he was saying something with a half cough, you know, he coughed, throw the defense attorney out, coughed the judge, you know, or something like that. That's possible, but it's not going to be very likely. You know what I mean? Okay, so. I don't think he's trying to rigidly fix the word order as far as the adverb is concerned. He puts it in brackets to indicate that it's not a necessary part, and it's also not really something that's fixed word order-wise. Then the examples in Greek here, he gives you the examples of just subject verbs without any adverbs here anyway. We will get to adverbs later on, but I think he's chosen not to give you adverb forms yet. So these three examples in section 54 are just basically examples where, this full kairos engikin could be considered an adverbial phrase there without a fixed verb form, but actually this in Greek, it is a verb form. Engikin is a verb form. So ho kairos engikin is just subject verb. And a pethanen ho lusios is subject verb, and so topaideon uka pethanen is subject verb type of thing. The uk there could be considered an adverb, though. It's a negation. So the child is not dead. Or better translation, we talked about this yesterday, but a better translation of that in English would be the child did not die. Because when you say is dead, you're getting a little slightly different connotation in English. Okay. Then he talks about the fact that were it not for the fact that the verb apethanen is intransitive, you wouldn't be able to tell for sure whether to paideon in sentence 3 was the subject or the object. But because of the nature of the verb being intransitive, it's got to be the subject. So that settles it here. There will be times, though, conceivable situations in which there may be an ambiguity that won't be resolved because the verb will be a transitive verb and it might go either way and you have to decide from context. Okay, now sentence 55, or section 55, is going to deal with another type of sentence structure that's a very important one. And it's important both in English and Greek. And Greek does quite a bit, has an interesting feature about it that is a little bit different than English in this respect. When we examine sentence 5 of section 45, going back to that list of sentences we saw back in chapter 7, we find that the structural meaning indicated by the subject is not the same as it is in the first four sentences. Sentence 5 was, his wife is a vegetarian. Now, at first glance, the structure of the sentence seems parallel to that of the other of the sentences considered in Lesson 7. Here again, the basic pattern is certainly noun 1, verb noun 2. In other words, his wife is the noun, wife is the noun, is the verb, and vegetarian is the next noun. So we certainly have the same basic pattern as far as noun, verb, noun. However, in the case of sentence 5, this cannot be rewritten as subject, verb, object, because we have a subject all right, we have a verb all right, but the last part can't be considered an object because there's no action that's being performed here, you see. The first noun in sentence 5, N1 equals wife, may indeed be called the subject, as it traditionally is, because of its position in the sentence, but it does not have the meaning performer of the action, simply because there's no action being performed. The verb to be does not denote action, it denotes a state. And so when you say his wife is a vegetarian, wife is not performing an action there in that sentence. So it is not really a meaning performer of the action, even though we still call it the subject. Further, the second noun, N2 equals vegetarian, does not indicate the receiver of the action. See, vegetarian isn't receiving the action of the verb to be. It's a stative verb. It's an equative verb is what he terms it. And it's not performing any action. In this sentence, as we said in section 45, the subject indicates that which is identified. The second noun, which is called not an object but a predicate nominative, indicates characteristics of identification, which are to be associated with the first noun. So in this sentence structure, what we have is a subject and a predicate nominative. Predicate nominative is the term that's used to describe this thing that's on the other side of the verb to be, the thing that is identifying the characteristic of the subject of the sentence. So it's called in English and in Greek a predicate nominative. Now, even in English, we use the term predicate nominative, even though we don't have nominative case endings. But there's a little bit of a hint for you as to what we're going to see in Greek. In Greek, you're going to see this thing in the nominative case as well. And so you'll see two things in the nominative case in Greek when you see this type of sentence structure. So it's very easy to identify this sentence structure in Greek as opposed to the subject-object type of sentence structure. Okay, so let's look at the section. Any questions on that? We'll look on section 56 and see how this comes out. Yes?
I have noticed some sentences in Greek where they've got a whole list of, like in Revelation somewhere, talking about the dragon.
Mm-hmm.
A whole list of things, and they're all in the nominative.
Right.
Are they all the predicate
nominative? Well, it'll vary. There can be a situation in which something is called, let's suppose we were having a translation of Isaiah 9:6 into Greek, where it says his name should be called Wonderful Counselor and so forth. Well, you might have a whole series of things. That would probably be in the accusative case because of the verb. But anyway, you might have a whole series of things in apposition all in the same case. And that will happen in the book of Revelation sometimes. But there is another little thing called a nominative absolute that we'll get into a little bit later on, where in more poetic type of expression or figurative type of expressions, there might be just a statement of a number of things in the nominative, almost kind of disjointed, and then you pick up with the other things. But what's really happening is the function is somewhat similar because all those things in the nominative are being equated together. In other words, they're put in apposition to each other, and they're all saying referring to the same thing. And so that mechanism, we will see that that's going to take it a step beyond this in most cases where you see them strung out like that. Not to say that you couldn't have a structure in which, for example, you find things like Paul, an apostle of Jesus Christ, so forth. Paul is in the nominative, apostles in the nominative, and of Jesus Christ is a genitive phrase, but you may see a whole string of things that are listing attributes of a person or offices that he holds or something like that. They're all strung out in the nominative because they're all referring to the same individual, and it's not that you are supplying a verb to be in those in between them all, but there's an understanding that these things are all being equated. Yes?
I have in the past been able to identify parts of speech without
Yes. to all, it'll be just like you saw before. It'll be in the nominative case. What you're going to see now in this structure, whether you know the meanings of the words or not, you're going to see two nominatives in a sentence. And by seeing those two nominatives in a certain type of sentence structure, you're going to be able to tell whether you know the lexical meanings of the words or not. If you know those case endings that we've got so far, and you can identify you've got two nominatives, you know you're dealing with this type of sentence structure even without knowing the lexical meanings.
We won't be able to identify the direct objects.
No, there is one ambiguity that's going to come, of course, because you've got two things in the nominative. How do you know which one is the subject and which one's the predicate nominative? That's where the big question comes. And we will look at about five criteria for deciding the two, between the two. But there's one major criteria, and that is the one that's the more definite of the two is the subject, and the one that's the least definite is the predicate nominative. That's the basic philosophy, but we'll look at five specific subcategories of that so you can tell the difference. See, when you've got a sentence structure like we saw before with a nominative and an accusative, the nominative is the subject and the accusative is the direct object, is pretty easy to tell. You've got two different forms there, you can separate them out. When you've got two things in the nominative, though, the question is which one's the subject and which one's the predicate nominative. Of course, since you have really an equative verb and the two things are being, you know, an equation is being drawn, it doesn't make a gigantic difference which one of the terms you put in first, since you're equating them anyway. But there are some considerations as far as deciding which is which. I guess I'm getting a little ahead of the story here because that's the last part of the chapter. Okay, let's look at section 56 here and see if we can break into this slowly here. Since this sentence 5 has the same general structure as sentence 1, that is, noun 1, verb noun 2, how shall we account for the fact that it and its constituents express different structural meanings? It is to be explained due to the presence in sentences of this type of a different kind of verb. It's the kind of verb, you see, that's making the difference in the structural meaning, because the basic pattern, noun 1, verb noun 2, is basically the same, but it's the kind of verb. Verbs of this kind are called equative verbs. Equative verbs have structural meanings as well as lexical meaning and are therefore function words. Remember on the test I told you to consider the verb to be as a function word in those examples, because that's really what's happening here. Equative verbs are like transitive verbs in that they may occur in structures of the general type noun 1, verb noun 2, but like intransitive verbs in that they take no objects and have no passive voice. So these equative verbs are kind of a cross breed, as it were. They are like the transitive verbs in that they are found in sentences where you have noun 1, verb noun 2. In other words, we've got nouns on both sides of the verb, but they don't have passive forms, and they don't have they don't take a direct object, even though they may take a predicate nominative. Yes.
Are they considered as being in the active
voice
then? Or do they have the word at all?
Well. Let me think about that. No, they just have to be considered active, because the fact that they don't have a passive form, in Greek, and we're using Greek terminology, there's no passive voice for them, and there's no middle voice for them either. So an equative verb is just going to be in what we call active forms. It's a little bit hard to call them active because there's no action, you see. So the forms, though, pretty much line up with what we would call active forms. Let me think. Well, actually, in Greek, there's two major equative verbs: the verb to be and the verb to become. And the verb to become, ginomai in Greek, is a form that looks like a passive form. Eimi is a form that looks like active forms. So the forms are looking that way, but it doesn't necessarily mean that ginomai is not called a passive form. It's what's called a deponent verb. I guess I'm getting way ahead here. So maybe I better hold that till we get to the actual examples. Let's just suffice it to say that we don't have active, passive, and middle voice type of structures in these equative verbs. The equative verbs are a little bit nice in respect that because they don't have all these different complications, the forms are generally pretty simple. Irregular, but simple. Okay, the verb to be is irregular in almost every language, and so you usually have to learn the forms of the verb to be, but fortunately their forms are very few, so you don't have all the complications that you have with the regular verb. Yes, John, did you have a question on that?
There seems to be some fact that relationship that doesn't really exist, but is the it appears that the equated verbs are have a sense of to be or existence implied in them,
mm-hmm.
State of existence implied in them, and that's why there's no passive to them. The passive basically, in a sense, is to show that it's a state of existence, right?
Well. In a certain sense, actually, the basic idea of passive is that something that's in the passive voice or the subject of a passive structure construction is receiving the action. It's receiving the action rather than performing the action. That's the basic distinction. Active is the subject performs the action. Passive is the subject receives the action. I think the essential problem with the verb like to be is that there's no action really taking place. It is expressing a state. And it is true that a passive construction, oftentimes when a person is receiving the action, he is being put into a new state. So there is a certain state of idea to a lot of passive verbs. That's definitely the case. In fact, we'll find some verbs that are, though they're technically have action, the action is not real active, if you want to put it that way. And especially in passive forms, there will be this state of idea that will come in. So you've got a point with regard to some verbs, but I think the basic grammatical distinctions are receiving the action versus performing the action. And since with an equative verb, there's no real action that's taking place, just because of the nature of the verb, it's more expressing just a pure state of idea, not associated with any kind of action. That's the reason why you're not seeing passive forms. Now, a person could suggest, now since there's two major verbs we're dealing with, the verb to be and the verb to become. The verb to become is a little more subtle because a person could conceive of that as being an action of some sort. You know, there's a change in state. Becoming involves a change in state, and that change in state is most likely going to be due to some kind of action that's performed. But the verb itself is not emphasizing any such action. It's just talking about the fact that the state is changing, not explaining how or why or what the actions were. So that's the reason why it's still in this equative verb category, at least functionally, both in Greek and in English. Okay, so let's read on here. The distinguishing feature of equative verbs, however, is the structural meaning which they impart to a sentence, thereby determining the total structure. So again, he's coming back to this structural type of definition. The thing that's really unique about the equative verb is its structural meaning. Is the fact that with equative verbs in Greek especially, you're going to see sentence structures that have two nominative forms in them. That really sets them apart. They're the only verbs that are used that way. So even if you don't even focus on the meaning of the verb, the fact that these verbs can be used in certain types of structures in the sentence and demand certain types of case endings and so forth makes them unique. Other verbs don't do that. So we can define them just as easily in terms of a structural definition by saying that equative verbs are verbs in Greek that can take two nominatives, or that can fit in between structures with two nominatives. And that really sets them apart. If you define them that way, you won't get them mixed up with any other kind of verb. Okay, the way in which the presence of equative verbs affects sentence structure will be at once apparent if we rewrite sentence 5 with transitive verbs. Okay, well, we start out with sentence 5, his wife is a vegetarian. There's an equative verb. And then his wife became a vegetarian. That's also an equative verb. It's still describing a state, even though there's a motion involving the state. But then his wife saw a vegetarian. There's a transitive verb. And his wife shot a vegetarian. There's a transitive verb. I don't know where he gets these examples. Okay? So the most important equative verbs in English are the verbs to be and to become. Those are the most important ones in English, and that's true in Greek too. Their equivalents are by far the most important equative verbs in Greek. So the equivalent in Greek to be and the equivalent in Greek to become are by far the most important ones in Greek. In English, we have to know whether a verb is equative or not. Generally speaking, if we encounter a verb previously unknown to us, we will not be inclined to regard it as possibly equative, for the class of equative verbs is far too restricted. If we should come across a sentence like, his wife Milver a vegetarian, for example, we would be more likely to understand Milver to indicate some action performed by the wife and received by the vegetarian, rather than that the wife is characterized in some unfamiliar way as a vegetarian. Okay, so he's just saying that the total set of equative verbs in English is very, very small. The only ones we were dealing with are the verb to be and to become. And so if you run across a new verb in sentence structure, you're going to be more than likely to assume, if you've never seen it before, that it is an action of some sort, because that's by far the most common category of verbs. Yes, Glenn?
Well, we're back to paradigms now, because Milbert with the E V on the end implies an action. Now this said his wife Milbert, a vegetarian.
Mm-hmm.
That would be more of a creative idea, right there.
That may lead you to suspect it more. Yes, that's a good point.
Not necessarily because you got shot.
The problem is that in English, paradigms aren't very reliable. In other words, we've got so many exceptions that it's a little bit harder to. One point you do have is that with that ed ending on there, you're not likely to associate that with an equative verb because our equative verbs. To be and to become don't have ed type suffixes and so forth. So that's a piece of information you can pick up on in English at least. But when you take the ed off, you're a little bit more left in the dark. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be an equative verb, but at least it seems to be more possible that it could be. Let's put it that way. It's so much easier in Greek, and you can really see what you're doing. You know, you don't have all these ambiguities. Okay. Five more minutes. Let's see if we can take a look at section 57 here. But his point here in listing these four sentences is to show the difference in sense between his wife is a vegetarian and his wife became a vegetarian from his wife saw a vegetarian. See, you can convert those last two to passive structures. A vegetarian was seen by his wife, or a vegetarian was shot by his wife. Those can both be put into passive constructions. But you can't do that with the first two. You can't say a vegetarian was been by his wife or something, or a vegetarian was become by his wife, and make much sense at all. And so that's the point that he's trying to establish here. In Greek sentences belonging to the corresponding structural type, I'm reading from section 57 now, there is an extra structural signal which helps us to recognize that a verb is equative, even if we've never seen it before. As we might expect, that extra signal is one of case. In Greek, when two nouns are joined by an equative verb, both nouns are in the nominative case. So this is the feature in Greek that is designating this type of sentence structure. Both nouns will be in the nominative case. So even if you don't know whether the verb's equative or not, having never seen it before, you'll be able to tell from the fact that the two nouns are in the nominative case. This extra clue is not generally very useful, however, as we are likely to know that the whole stock of equative verbs in Greek fairly early in the game. So, in other words, there aren't very many verbs at all, basically to be and to become, so you don't really have to worry about it that much. On the other hand, the absence of a fixed word order in Greek makes it difficult for us to distinguish which of the two nouns in the nominative case is the subject of an equative verb and which is the predicate nominative. That's the point I mentioned earlier. If you got both nouns in the nominative, how are you going to know which one's the subject, which one's the predicate nominative, especially since the word order shifts around in Greek? A way out of this difficulty will be apparent if we notice that in a sentence in which two nouns are joined by an equative verb, the two nouns are rarely simply equated in such a way as to be completely interchangeable. Thus, God is love does not mean the same thing as love is God. In sentences of this type, the subject is comparatively definite and special, the predicate nominative less definite and less special. The subject is, as it were, identified by being associated with a more general notion or class. Thus, in thieves are cowards, thieves is the subject, and the sentence indicates that they are to be included within a larger class, cowards. If, on the other hand, we have cowards or thieves, we make thieves the more general term and would infer from the statement that there are some thieves who are not cowards. Okay, see what he's getting at here. In equative sentences, when you are trying to make an equative sentence, what you're usually doing is you've got a particular subject in mind, and you're equating that subject with some quality, characteristic, attribute, or some other larger group of things, stating that this particular thing that I'm talking about has this property, but other things have that property as well. So what he's saying is that the general distinction in a predicate nominative construction is such that the subject is the more special or definite of the two things, and the predicate nominative is the more general of the two things. That's the basic criterion we're using to decide these, because the assumption is that you're trying to identify a specific subject with a more general category rather than vice versa. Now, sometimes that can get ambiguous, and in fact, some of the examples it gives, you almost want to reverse, but you'll see what I mean when we get into those examples. But that's the philosophy anyway. The subject is more specific, the predicate nominative is more general. So if you keep that basic philosophy in mind, then it'll help you to make the decision in many of these cases as far as which one's the subject, which one's the predicate nominative. Now, this is the problem only in Greek. In English, word order takes care of that. But in Greek, we do have the ambiguity because word order is variable, And in this particular sentence type, both nouns will have been the nominative case. And so that's where we're running into a problem. So section 58 then gets into the Greek aspect, and we'll see it in more specific detail. In Greek, since the word order is not fixed, some other way of identifying the subject of an equative verb must be sought. The notions of definiteness and indefiniteness provide us with such a way. We may lay it down as a general principle that if two nouns in the nominative case are connected by an equative verb in Greek, the more definite of the two is the subject. So that's the basic rule. The more definite of the two is the subject. Now here's five subcategories of this to make this decision. And we're out of time here, so we'll have to look at these tomorrow. But the first one you'll notice, if one of the two nouns is a proper name, it is a subject. A proper name is always more definite than something more general, because you're talking about a specific person with a specific name or a specific object with a specific name. And then you'll see the fact that one has the article and the other doesn't. That will make the decision, and several other things here, too. So we'll have to stop here and continue with this next Tuesday. No assignment. What's that? I don't think so. Not really a proper name, but because it has the article, it would be regarded as more definite if it was associated with some other noun. In other words, I think if you had two nouns being equated together, and also is one of those, that would still be considered the more definite. In other words, suppose we had a sentence where it says hotheos ein tophos, God was the light. Well, we would be, even though it's the light, even both nouns have the article, the word God is still going to get preference over there, because it's not a proper name, but it's more like a proper name than light is. You see what I mean? It's more definite. Yes. Yes. Oh, it's right here. Okay, sorry.
Glad I was here yesterday.